Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week we explore a new subject about either UFOs or some aspect of the paranormal. And tonight, it's UFOs, which is actually my favorite subject. And our guest, I am just so excited about, is longtime pioneering researcher, Anne Druffel. Now, before I introduce our guest and what we're going to talk about tonight, let me just give you a little bit of sighting news. I received a call just last night from a gentleman in Virginia. His name is Joe Gardner, and he told me that he saw a UFO just exactly 1 week ago. He stepped out of his workplace in Huntington, Virginia, when he saw a very large ice cream cone-shaped object hovering on the horizon. And he watched it as soon as he saw it, he said he got kind of a telepathic link to it, as if they knew he was there and that he was watching them. And he watched it for about 10 minutes before it started to move, and it went around a hillside and disappeared. Now, he went out the next night to the same place, and it was there again. And this time, he did what every UFO witness should do, go get another person. And what he did is he found a security guard, and he pulled the security guard out of his booth and led him to the street and faced him in the direction of this object, and he didn't even say anything. The security guard shouted out, "Wow, what's that?" It was the very same thing, a very large, glowing, ice cream cone-shaped object, which hovered in place and then for about 10 minutes and then disappeared. It moved away. Now, he went there the third night. It was gone, but he just called me last night. It was back again. This time he had a whole crowd of people watching it. They had binoculars.
Oh.
And they didn't have their cameras set up, but they're getting them set up. He really feels that this UFO is showing itself to him. He's had a number of sightings in the past, actually, which have involved some telepathic instances. For example, he saw a very large object, diamond-shaped, he said, and he telepathically thought to it, "I want to go on board."
Uh-oh.
And he said he got this feeling in the back of his head, being hit like a bat. It said, "No, not now." So this is a very exciting case. There's lots of stuff going on, and I just wanted to alert you all to that. But now let me introduce my guest. I'm just so excited. Our guest tonight is Anne Druffel. She has been a researcher for a really long time, since April 1957, when she joined the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, better known as NICAP. And since then, she has researched more than 2,000 UFO reports in the Los Angeles basin alone, including landings, photo cases, abductions, and a huge variety of paranormal phenomena. She has written more than 180 articles for numerous journals and magazines, and has appeared on many, many radio and television programs, and has written three very influential books in the UFO field, including The Tujunga Canyon Contacts, which was actually co-authored with D. Scott Rogo. Mm-hmm. Also, How to Defend Yourself Against Alien Abduction, a very unique book. And the book we're going to talk about tonight, which is called Firestorm, Dr. James McDonald's Fight for UFO Science. Now, Firestorm is actually the fascinating story of an intellectual giant, James McDonald, and a fearless fighter who nearly accomplished what nobody else has yet done, examined the phenomena of UFOs through the uncompromising eye of the mainstream scientific community. Now, this book is more than a biography of an incredible man. It delves deeply into the behind-the-scenes manipulations, politics, and intrigues encountered by McDonald and other researchers who have sought to get this most important topic studied in an objective manner by the appropriate authorities. Now, Druffel was able to gain unprecedented access to McDonald's files and archives and all of his many cases, allowing her to document the early days of the official UFO cover-up as it was actually being put into place. So, Druffel's pioneering investigations into the UFO phenomena have had a profound effect on this field, and definitely on me. So I'm really, really excited. Thank you so much, Anne, for coming onto the show.
Well, thank you very much.
So, I have to heap some praise on you. I mean, you were in this field long before I was even born, and I actually wrote a book, UFOs Over California, and you were all through the early literature. I mean, your influence on this field is really amazing, and your research is just, it's fantastic.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I really want to thank you for that, first of all. And now, is it true you saw a UFO when you were a little girl?
Yes. I lived in Long Beach, California, and this was in the summer of 1945, and World War II was still raging in the Pacific. I was outside, and I saw in the northeastern sky a very bright globe of yellowish-white light. This was the full daytime. And since the age of 9, I had been reading books on astronomy, I had some knowledge of what should be in the sky, and this thing wasn't anything that looked like it should be in the sky. And I was so intrigued that I watched it for an hour and a half.
Wow.
As it was very, very high in the sky, and as it traveled from the northeast to the northwest. And my mother saw it with me, and she looked at it puzzled, you know, and she said, well, maybe it's part of balloon of defenses, because Long Beach, of course, was a major port. It still is. And it was very much involved in the war effort in the Pacific. And, of course, I knew that there were no balloon defenses in Long Beach, you know, like there was in England and other places. But she went in to cook dinner, and I continued to watch this thing just fascinated. And then all of a sudden, it seemed to, the only way I can describe is let some parts of itself away. And it wasn't a balloon breaking up with the parts falling to Earth. The parts would take varying paths up and away from the main object. And these little parts were much tinier than the main object, but I could see them when the sun glinted on them. The sun was in the west. It was about 4:30.
Wow.
And I was so startled. I watched about 16 to 20 of these little things come out of the big object or off of the big object, and it was so startling to me, and I was so awed and afraid that I ran into the house, yelling for my mother, please come out and see this thing. It's falling apart, and it's not acting as if gravity is acting right on it.
Wow.
You know, I don't know where the words came from me, because I've never been a technical person. but she wouldn't. My mother was cooking dinner, and she wouldn't come out again. And I was so frightened that I could not go out again to watch the thing. But then about 2 or 3 weeks later, the first atom bomb was exploded over Hiroshima, essentially ending the war with Japan, and the start of the end of war with Japan. And for many, many, many years, I couldn't figure this out, but it stayed in the back of my mind. But then they began to released classified material, and I realized that when I saw this thing in early summer, it was of 1945. It was just about the time the first atom bomb was exploded at the Frenchman's Flat, the first experimental atom bomb.
Right.
And I began to speculate and to hypothesize, actually, that possibly this was a UFO, a large UFO, that had been brought to survey the Earth or to conduct surveillance on the Earth, because we had entered the atomic age. And by that time, I was in UFO research. It was well after 1957 that I began to realize what this thing was that I saw when I was a school kid.
All right. So how did you enter UFO research? I mean, how did you go from being,
Well, the thing I saw in the sky never left me. You know, I mean, I remembered it. And then when they began to have the stories in the press about Kenneth Arnold and other sightings, I began to realize that perhaps what I had seen might have been something like what they were calling flying saucers, because the people originally who reported UFOs, aside from Kenneth Arnold, of course, were laughed at. And when I had tried to tell my friends what I had seen that day in 1945, they laughed at me. They said, "Oh, Anne, you don't know what you're talking about, you know." So I had been treated exactly the way that early witnesses after 1947 were treated.
Well, you know, what's interesting about your saying is this is like way before abductions and humanoids and all of this. So did you think extraterrestrial or aliens when you saw that?
I didn't think extraterrestrial, no. I didn't know what it was. It was so awesome and so fearful to me that... And when a couple of weeks later, when the news of the bomb over Hiroshima came in the papers, when I was trying to read it and understand, you know, what was an atomic bomb, I felt the same kind of awe and fear, intense, that I had felt when I saw the object sending out little parts of itself, is the way I can explain. Now, you know, I would say that was possibly a carrier craft, a large carrier craft, very high in maybe even beyond our atmosphere, letting out smaller scout ships to come down and conduct closer surveillance to the Earth. And since several years ago, I had a very good friend, a fellow parapsychologist, I also do psychic research, who had been working in a aircraft plant during the war, and he had seen something just about the same time that I saw the big thing in the sky sending out these tiny things. He had seen a strange object maneuvering over, I believe it was Hollywood or West L.A. So I never was able to actually link that together, but it's just speculation.
Wow.
But that's what started me on UFOs, you see.
Right.
And then when NICAP was formed, I had read Kehoe's first book, and when Major Kehoe formed NICAP, I thought, I'm going to join this guy, you know, because by that time I was working. I was a social caseworker, and I had the time to do it, and... It intrigued me. That's how I became involved in UFO research.
Right. So what were some of your first major cases? What was that like?
Oh, my. There were so many of them. First major cases. Well, of course, we were engaged in the Heflin photo case in 1965.
Wow.
And then I can't remember the exact year now, but I've written a lot about it. There was a case of a photo taken of a UFO in Yorba Linda, California, which is southeast of where I live here in Pasadena. And it was a photo taken by a young guy. He was 14. But I studied that thoroughly, and I had six scientific study groups study the photo, and they all agreed that it did not appear to be hoaxed. So I've had many cases like that in this, so many exciting cases.
Right. You actually have that photograph in the James McDonald book, huh? In the Firestorm book.
That's the Heflin photos.
No, you have the Yorba Linda photograph on page 275.
Okay, so once you write a book, it sort of goes out of your mind.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean, but I remember because I just read the book, and actually for the second time, and it's very gripping. And
a very strange case because it wasn't any more than three or 4 feet, in diameter, and it was shaped like a man's top hat. This object that we called him Tom X to hide his identity.
It's very interesting. Yeah, it's an interesting photo. It shows the little antenna or landing gear or something going down.
Yes. It seems like he said that he saw four little landing gears coming from the bottom, But only three of them appeared in the photo due to, I think, the perspective of the photo from which the photo was taken.
Right. Another interesting case I thought was the Harrison Bailey case.
Oh, my, yes.
Because, I mean, you actually got the photographs, which are in your other book,
yes.
How to Defend Yourself Against Alien Abduction.
Yes. Reverend Bailey and I, we're friends, we're longtime friends. He's still a Protestant minister in Pasadena. And those are very interesting photos because they seem to indicate that what he had seen and photographed at night in his home were two humanoid shapes, two humanoid creatures that had somehow appeared in his a studio apartment at night, but that they had appeared first as faces against the window shade and then developed into a full-bodied creature. And then as he was taking their picture, as they were dashing out through a door, it shows the picture, the Bailey photos show some kind of dematerialization going on of the body, you see. In
right.
other words, and then when he followed them into the room into which they had dashed, it was a bathroom with no other door, they weren't there. And he saw something disappearing through the wall. And so that's one of the cases that set me onto the fact that I now have a rather firm hypothesis that the so-called abducting humanoids are not a physical occupants from physical UFOs, but a separate phenomenon that can materialize into our space-time temporarily, but then it disappears back into its own what we call altered realm or other dimension, if you want to use that word.
Right. But they can leave radiation burns and landing traces, and they take people physically away at some point, right?
Well, now...
Because, I mean, people are not where they're supposed to be during a missing time case, at least in some cases.
Well, you see, the separate phenomenon that I have just hypothesized about has been known to every culture, major and minor, throughout the millennia. And it is described as the third order of creation by the Muslims, for example. They call it the Al-Jinn. But in every culture, it seems to sexually harass human beings and to materialize and dematerialize, to shapeshift into various forms. And it is extremely deceptive. And according to other cultures, it addresses or comes in contact with human beings while the human beings are in an altered state. And the altered state is not dreaming or anything like that. It is not yet identified precisely by psychologists in the UFO field, but that abductions supposedly take place in an altered state that is so real to the person going through the scenario that it seems to be that they are in physical space-time. But actually, they are in an altered state of existence that is perhaps easy for the creatures to work in.
Right. Well, I think that's true in a lot of cases. There are some outlying cases, like the Filiberto Cardenas case in Florida, where he was actually abducted in view of other people. And there's a couple of cases like that, which make me wonder how altered of a state are we in, you know?
Yes, there are a few cases that are quite puzzling, like the Cardenas case. And also the Travis Walton case,
right.
And even Betty and Barney Hill. Those are the cases that puzzle me, because Travis Walton was seen the UFO that they called it that knocked a beam of light toward Travis and knocked him backwards was seen by five of his fellow forest workers. You see. So I don't know what to think of that, and the only thing I can hypothesize is that a very, very few so-called abductions might be perpetrated by occupants from physical craft?
It seems to me that we have to allow for the, at least the possibility that there are objective aliens, and at the same time allow for the possibility, like as you say, that this is a phenomenon that is sort of putting on a mask and tracking cultures, because it is highly symbolic, I think, a lot of these cases.
Yeah, symbolic. You mean the way they dress and the clothes the creatures wear?
Yeah, and, I mean, there's just other factors and that I find very interesting. Well, what about the case you wrote a book with D. Scott Robo on the Tujunga Canyon contacts? How did that begin?
Well, you see, I had been in a NICAP subcommittee as an investigator since 1957. And then, in the 1980s is when the Tujunga Canyon witnesses began to report their abduction scenarios to us. And, of course, the general UFO field, when abductions began to be reported so heavily around 1973, even the most objective of us thought, well, the field has taken a different course. You see, the occupants are doing something different than just mere surveillance from craft or landing, you know, and then scooting off when someone comes near. That they are actually abducting human beings. So when the five, actually there were six, the Tujunga Canyon witnesses were reporting these so-called abduction scenarios to me, I spent several years in investigating that in depth. And then you wanted to know how the Tujunga Canyon Contacts was written?
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing book. It's really one of the landmark books, and really one of the first full-length studies of a UFO contact case, other than the Betty and Barney Hill case and a few others.
Yes, I had written some little articles about the Tujunga Canyon contacts, the individual scenarios of these individual witnesses, all of which were very rational, productive, honest women. And let's see now. The parapsychologist, he was quite famous, D. Scott Rogo, learned of these cases that were going on, and he approached me with the idea of co-authoring a book about this, because there were five, actually six witnesses, and about, you know, several scenarios that they were describing.
Have they been hypnotized at this point?
They had been hypnotized, yes, to some degree. But when D. Scott Rogo entered the case and we investigated together, we had other hypnotic sessions done with them. And we investigated the case even in more depth. And that was the first book that I wrote. D. Scott Rogo was, even though he was a famous author, he was kind enough to be the co-author. it was really an experience. But the Tujunga Canyon Contacts, it was first published in 1980. And then it was republished in paperback in 1989. And as it was being, we wrote two new chapters for the, it was first published in 1985, I'm sorry. And then when the republication came about in 1989, Scott and I wrote two new chapters. And by that time, I had realized that three of the five major witnesses of the Tujunga Canyon contacts had been able to fend off, to fight off the creatures, and to end the abduction scenarios with very simple techniques, simple mental and physical techniques.
Right.
And I pointed this out in my chapter in the soft cover edition published in 1989. And that's what started me on a further investigation of resistance techniques.
Right, which led to your second book, How to Defend Yourself.
By that time, I had more than 70 witnesses who had described a different technique by which they were able to end the scenarios. And the way they ended the abduction scenarios, all of them, they used different techniques, which are described in the book, of course, but they found that when the technique was employed against the creature that was harassing them, they woke up into full waking state. The witnesses did. They felt themselves wake up into a full waking state, and when they were fully awake, the creatures were gone, and the whole scenario had ended.
Which seems to prove that it's taking place in an altered state of consciousness.
I would say that the huge majority of them are, yes, if not all of them. But, of course, this is controversial. There are people in the field whom I respect highly, and they are friends of mine who don't agree with me. they think, you know, that abductions are physical, that they are perpetrated by physical occupants from UFOs that, you know, fly around the skies.
Well, couldn't they be interdimensional? I mean, couldn't they just come physically and then they fly back into another dimension and live in a different vibration? I mean,
that's one of the hypotheses that's floating around now. I don't think we really know enough about UFOs to know if the ones that seem to come out from outer space into our atmosphere are purely physical. You know, if there's some physical base nearby, perhaps the moon, and come to do surveillance on the Earth in a purely physical state, we don't know. But as you suggest, it may be that they do come out of another dimension, become physical in our space-time, you know, fly around the sky and are chased by jet pilots, caught on radar. We really don't know enough about it.
Right. Well, you're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Bennett, and our guest tonight is pioneering UFO researcher Anne Druffel, who has written a recent book called Firestorm, Dr. James E. McDonald's Fight for UFO Science. Now, I have a number here that people can actually order the book from if they call during working hours. It's 1-800-366-0264, or you can go to www.fifthworld.com. That's 5th world.com. So let's
and
talk
also,
about...
It's sold on Amazon also, easily available on Amazon.
Oh, good.
And if they want to order an autographed copy, they can get one through my website, which is www.andruffel.com.
Okay, and that's one L, D-R-U-F-F-E-L.
E-L, and no E on Ann. A-N-N.
Okay, yeah. Now, this was an amazing book. You know, I really appreciate a book that's written in a scholarly way and just filled with, you know, footnotes and lots of, there's so much research that went into this book. And I can tell you had a great time writing it because it really moves along.
It was wonderful. You see, Dr. McDonald would interact with civilian UFO research groups. He was a top scientist, an atmospheric physicist, highly regarded in the scientific community. But yet he would interact and work with civilian UFO research groups. And he was an amazing man. But he died tragically in 1971 after just 6 years with us publicly in the field. And we grieved for the man because he had become actually a friend to us. And I had grieved for 20 years for Jim McDonald, you know, hoping he was all right because he apparently committed suicide. And the chance to write the book was my end of my grief, because I know now he's in a place of light.
Wow. So how did you come to be able to get access to his files, and what inspired you to write this book? I mean,
well, it was strange. It was almost synchronistic. I am a screenwriter, you know, as well as books and articles. And I had written a screenplay about McDonald's, and I had sent a copy of it to his widow, Betsy McDonald, whom I had met, you know, when Jim was alive, and shortly afterwards. And Yes. And she was intrigued by the screenplay that never went any place yet, but I'm still working on it. But we met in Tucson, and it was her idea that perhaps I would like to archive his files. They had what they called the UFO room in their home in Tucson, Arizona.
Wow, one room for UFO research.
Yes, well, it was a small room, but it was the UFO room, as the family called it. He had a large family. And she had always wondered how to get those files archived, because all of his scientific work on atmospheric physics had been archived by the University of Arizona at Tucson, of course. But they had never accepted his UFO work. And so together with Betsy and friends of Jim McDonald, we called him Jim, his colleagues at the university, we were able to get the personal collection section of the University of Arizona at Tucson to accept his UFO files.
Wow.
And I got a grant from the Fund for UFO Research to archive them. It took about 4 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And during that time, Betsy had the idea that perhaps a book could be written about Jim's UFO research as well.
Well, he wanted to write a book.
And asked me to do it.
Right. I mean, he was going to write his own book at one point?
He was indeed. You see, this man had access to cases that had never been declassified before, and he Project Blue Book four times. The fourth time he went, Project Blue Book had been disbanded, but the Project Blue Book files were in archives in government hands, and he got access to more than 100 radar visual cases that no one had ever heard about, military radar visual cases in which the UFO was seen in the sky, seen by pilots, caught on radar by the pilots, and also seen by witnesses on the ground at the same time and caught on radar from the ground.
Wow.
What Jim McDonald called a radar visual case. And to him, this constituted the nearest thing to proof that he had ever been able to get, you see, that UFOs were an actual scientific question and that should be studied by science on an interdisciplinary basis. This is what he had, you know, one of his intentions. And so when he got these radar visual cases, he copied 100 of them and brought them back to Tucson. And he was going to write a book about these radar visual cases because he was one of the few people in the world, I guess, who had the scientific knowledge in several science fields in order to interpret the information in these 100 radar visual cases that the government had formally classified. But about this time, he began to slip into a depressive state. And we don't know if it was because of family problems that he was having, or there's some indication, which I put in the book in detail, that things were happening to him that perhaps were from other forces, perhaps government interference, because at that time the government did have the CIA, I believe it was, did have an agency that was studying ways to bring on depressive states to people without their knowledge. And that's described in Firestorm 2. And, you know, I always wondered, and so did most of his colleagues in the field, had often wondered how in the world could this marvelous man commit suicide.
Right when he's getting all this vital information, too.
Yes, he was on the verge of getting the scientific community at large to regard UFOs as a serious scientific question. He gave hundreds of talks to the most prestigious scientific organizations in the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand.
Right. That's one of the fascinating things about your book was the story of him butting heads with government people and scientists and like J. Allen Hynek.
Yes.
When he discovered J. Allen Hynek was, you know, basically dumbing down the evidence, I guess.
Yes, J. Allen Hynek had been chosen as scientific consultant for Project Blue Book almost from the beginning. And it was his job, I think he regarded it as his job, to find an answer for cases if he could. And so when McDonald went to Project Blue Book the first time, it was active then, he found cases that he had studied himself and that NICAP had studied in depth, and he found that on these same cases that were in the Project Blue Book files, Dr. Hynek had written meteor or lenticular cloud, you know, to explain these cases which couldn't under any circumstances be identified as these things.
Right, like Major Quintanilla told Dr. McDonald that the case where the two police officers chased a UFO across two states was a satellite.
I believe that might have been the answer that Hector Quintanilla gave him.
I just read it, so I mean it's astonishing.
Okay. Yeah, yes, a satellite. Yes, it was illogical explanations like this that had been written as explanations on these very fine cases. And so that's what set McDonald against Hynek at first. And it just took him a couple of days to travel to Chicago to Hynek's office at Northwestern University. And he went through the door and he slammed his fist on the Hynek's desk and said, you know, what are you doing? You know, the exact words are in the book. But that was the way that Hynek and McDonald first met. But they tried to work together. I knew Hynek also because Dr. Hynek, after McDonald had died, Hynek took over as the chief scientist in the UFO research field. He too was a fine man, and it was quite evident that he had this job as scientific consultant with Project Blue Book because that was the way that he could send his kids to college. It was extra funds that he could send his kids to college. So I think he felt that he had to do what the government wanted. But afterwards, he certainly changed his opinion and became a very much a proponent that UFOs are a scientific question.
Yeah, I think he always tried to keep it in the scientific realm, though, because I know in the Hudson Valley sighting book he wrote with Bob Pratt and Philip Imbrogno, he wanted to keep out some of the close encounter cases and just focus on just the sightings.
Yes.
Which yes. I thought was interesting.
Yes, he didn't do much into the abduction scenarios, did he? That's right.
Yeah, it's still a very, very controversial subject, as you say.
Yes, it is.
So, do you think that he was committed suicide, or do you think, I mean, your personal opinion? Because reading the book, it's an amazing story, and I really wonder.
Yes. I wondered too, of course. I respect Betsy McDonald very highly, and she feels that that her husband was sent into the depressive state through family problems solely, and she does not accept the fact that perhaps a part of the depression, at least, was brought on by other means, you know, other unknown means.
Right. Well, you mentioned in the book that she was worried when he started taking on UFO research because she considered it an unsolvable problem, and she knew he was not going to let it go.
That's right. That's right. And you see, MacDonald always, he never neglected his atmospheric physics work. He did everything that came over his desk, you know, both as a professor and as a researcher in atmospheric physics. But he added UFO research to his life. And, of course, you can imagine what that would do to a person and to a family who was caught in a position where the father was out of the home so often on UFO research, not on his atmospheric physics work, which he did at the same time, but taking time for UFO research too,
right, when
traveling
he
to other cities.
When he researched the case, he really researched the case. I mean, he would interview hundreds of people and triangulate and go to each location. And
yes.
My goodness.
He was one of the finest researchers that ever lived. But, of course, we do have scientists in the field now who are extremely good researchers, and we're so fortunate to have them. But MacDonald had a mind that would extend to many, many questions in science, you see. And that whenever he found a question that he couldn't answer himself, he would read and study and become expert in this new field of science, or, you know, a branch of science. And I suppose most scientists do not have minds like that. The man was a near genius, if not a genius.
All right. Well, you have this amazing story in the book about how he changed the way people play baseball.
Yes.
I mean,
the weight of the bat.
Right.
Yes. Uh-huh.
He didn't even want to go to the game, but he studied it and decided that it was all depending on the speed of the bat and the weight of it.
Yes, he was the one that proved that a lighter bat is more likely to produce a home run than a heavy bat.
Can you imagine? You can have such an influence on the world.
Yes.
And not even know it.
And he's the first scientist, one of the first scientists who brought up the problem of the ozone layer, the hole in the ozone layer. This was in, 1970, that he testified before Congress on this, together with other scientists and other researchers. But he was one of the first to alert us to the problem of the ozone layer.
Wow, he was really a forward-thinking man.
Yes, he was.
But
not only that, he was humorous, he was sociable, he was extremely likable, and he treated everybody in the field alike. Like when he would come to a meeting, whenever he was in town, we would have what we called a party. But actually, it was a meeting of from 10 to 30 UFO researchers. And he would sit there and distribute his material around, and he would speak at the rate of understanding of the least technical person in the room. And I always understood what James MacDonald was saying. I do not understand a lot when scientists talk, but I always understood when he spoke. But of course, there were other, less technical people, too, in the room, but there were also scientists. But then when he'd get in the corner with scientists, he'd start in with the scientific language. But we always appreciated him for that, that he treated everyone alike.
Right. Now, is it true he never actually believed that there was an official UFO cover-up, and he thought the government was just following up?
That's right. This was one of the great questions in his life. He had come to the conclusion, a rather firm conclusion, that the problems that we saw with government disregard for UFOs was due to a grand foul-up, he called it, a grand foul-up rather than a true cover-up. But toward the end of his life, I had investigated, all of his UFO files. he was writing to people, as other scientists and other researchers, questioning, might there be a cover-up? You see, he was beginning to question in his own mind that perhaps there was a government cover-up.
Right. It seems to me he was almost naive about it, entrusting the government, because, I mean, the answers he was getting from them were, as he said, ridiculous.
Yes.
And contradictory and evasive. And
yes.
Right down the line. And he was very, very aggressive, calling every Air Force base around whenever there was a sighting.
Oh, yes. And they would speak with him. You know, he could speak to just about anybody that he called because of his reputation.
Wow. So I wonder what he would be like if he were in the field now.
The field would be quite different, Preston. I have often wondered that myself, and so have his other friends.
If he had succeeded.
Yes, if he had succeeded, if he had not been stopped by whatever did stop him and took him away from us, he might have been able to break through into heavily classified material, because wherever he went into military and scientific areas of the government, people would tell him secretly cases that they knew about or had seen themselves. And he had so many cases that were classified that he couldn't talk about. And these have never been found. He wrote these in what's called his pocket notebooks. And he mentions these in his handwritten journals, which we have. But we have never found the pocket notebooks yet. But I'm not giving up on that either.
Well, so are his files available for public viewing at the university?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. It's the personal collection section of the University of Arizona at Tucson.
Wow. And so what do they basically contain? I mean, 4 years? That's a lot of files, huh?
Well, actually, it would be, let's see, 16 years, because he started in 58, investigating cases in and around Tucson. And this was done publicly, but it was not done publicly with a UFO research organization. And the people who lived in and around Tucson knew he would be interested in UFO reports. So they would call him and tell him what they had seen, and he would investigate cases in depth in his own area. So all of those cases are in his files. And then when he entered the public UFO research field with NICAP, all of those cases are in his files, in his archives. His journals are there. It's just a wonderful collection.
So you had to read did you read all of it and go through? I mean, it's an enormous book, Firestorm. It's 600 some pages.
I know. In the book, there is just a mention of a few of the cases that he investigated.
Wow.
Because no one could do all of them. but they're there for researchers. And researchers have been tapping into the files since they were archived a few years ago.
Wow. I mean, so are you working on any new books now?
Well, I just finished a book called Standing in God's Light in End Times. And that's out now in Amazon and, my website and other BN.com. It's rather widely available. But that does not have anything about UFOs in there. But there is an interesting possible connection between what I feel is the cause of UFO abductions and the present war on terror, which is part of what people are calling possible end times. My book, Standing in God's Light in End Times, is, it's a different subject. It was co-authored by a clairvoyant that I had written two other books with previously. And Armin Marcotte is the co-author. And it was his predictions regarding end times, and then my follow-up research on his predictions. So it's a very complicated, complex book, but it's only about 230 pages.
Wow. Well, you're really quite accomplished in this field. Now, Firestorm, I should tell people again where they can order that. Here's the phone number, and again, this is for business hours only. 1-800-366-0264. And the website is www.fifthworld.com. And you have a website too?
Yes, www.andruffles.com. And they can obtain an autographed copy of Firestorm or any of my six books there.
Six books?
Yes, I've written six books.
So how long did it take you to write Firestorm?
Oh, my goodness. About together with the research, about 5 years.
Wow. I mean, you can definitely tell because it's really an amazing...
Yes, and it took another 5 years to find a publisher.
Oh, really? Granite Publishing? Or Wildflower Press?
Wildflower Press.
A division of Granite Publishing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did an amazing job.
Yes, they did. It's beautiful. Beautifully done.
It really is, and it's filled with photographs of, like, you've got UFO landing photographs and actual UFO photographs, too. It's very interesting.
And some of his friends in the field said that McDonald comes alive in the book.
Oh, yeah, I mean, the story is gripping. I mean, you have the whole Rex Heflin case in there. Now, you weren't involved personally on that one?
Peripherally, I was. The NICAP subcommittee... several of the people who were older than I was, because I was one of the younger members at the time, they did most of the investigative work, but I did some of the peripheral work on the Heflin photos. But then several years ago, Heflin, when he received the original copies back, which had been taken by so-called NORAD men,
right.
When he got the original cases back, all of the older people in the subcommittee that was NICAP subcommittee had died, and I was available, and he knew me, you see. So Heflin contacted me to go on with study, a reanalysis of his photos,
yeah, which
we did.
Which continue to stand up. One of the best photo cases, I think.
There is a group... I don't know if it's a group that works together or just about six other researchers in this country that are trying to get digital copies of the originals from me so that they can prove that these pictures are hoaxed. And, of course, I would be willing to provide digital copies to anyone because I am convinced that those are genuine UFO photos. But there is a scientist, Eric Kelson, who did the computer enhancement work on our reanalysis in 2000 of the Heflin photos. And he has a second paper that he is writing, a very much more technical paper than the first one that was published. And he wants to finish that before we make the digital copies of the original photographs available.
All right. So, well, let me ask you another question that's kind of not related, but still UFO. Is what do you think of all these UFO crash stories, like Roswell and Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, Shag Harbor? I mean, there's a bunch of new books coming out now. So, wouldn't that blow the whole theory off that this is not a paraphysical thing, that it is physical, if this was true?
Oh, well, I accept the fact that the UFOs that whiz around the Earth and are photographed and are caught on radar and just chased by jet pilots are physical craft. That is my theory.
Okay.
And that it's very possible that some of them have crashed. But, you see, I don't know any witnesses to crashes that is not my area of expertise. And so I can't, I can't judge about the crashes, but I would say yes, the one at Roswell did leave a debris field. I can accept the debris field, as far as bodies found, things like that, I would have to know the witnesses personally and do the investigation myself before I would accept it beyond just hypothetical.
So no one's ever talked to you about that, and all the witnesses you've talked to?
No, the crashes, no.
Oh, interesting.
It is, isn't it? I'm just not in the right place, Southern California.
are you still actively doing UFO cases?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, really?
I work on cases where so-called abductees are trying to resist the creatures. And I have two or three cases that I work with on that, giving them advice, helping them, trying to find out which resistance techniques will work to bring them out of the altered state in which these scenarios occur.
Right. I've actually referred your book to more than one abductee.
Oh, thank you.
So,
thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Oh, it's amazing. What's amazing about that book is it's unique.
Is how to defend yourself against alien abduction?
Right. I mean, there's no other book like it in the field.
It's unique and controversial. And
which is what a book should be.
I'm a persona non grata from abduction conferences.
Well, it's what a book should be. A book should be controversial. But
yes. But yeah. It was the information that came to me, the really well-researched information. I had to put it down.
Yeah, and I've run across similar cases myself where people have used those types of techniques, so I know.
You have.
Absolutely. With like the sound, uh-huh. or like moving a finger,
mm-hmm.
and things like that.
Uh-huh.
So.
Have you written articles about that?
No, I
or
haven't.
Books.
But
perhaps you could write a book. Another book.
You never know.
Oh.
There's all these cases coming out now. It's definitely happening. So we're pretty much at the end of our hour, though.
Yes.
And do you have any last words for our audience out there? Have we covered everything pretty good?
You certainly have, Preston. It's been wonderful being on the phone with you, and I just appreciate your interest so much.
Oh, thank you. The honor is mine, really. I mean, it's been a delight, definitely.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's our show. You've been listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and our guest tonight has been Anne Druffel, who has written the amazing book, Firestorm, Dr. James McDonald's Fight for UFO Science, which is published by Wildflower Press, and you can order it during business hours at 1-800-366-0264, or go to Anne Druffel's website, which is her name, AnneDruffel.com, or fifthworld.com, or amazon.com. And I really suggest you go right out and buy this book. It's gripping, it's poignant, it's moving, and it's very educational and entertaining. So that's our show for tonight. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you can join us next week when our guest will be John Magnus, who is going to be talking about his book, Out-of-Body Experiences and the Nature of Reality. Until then, have a great evening.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Preston.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, that's okay. I'll be listening if I can.
Okay. Well,
did this go out live?
Yes.
Uh huh. Wonderful. Okay.
All right. Well, thanks again.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate everything you said about the books. Okay, and write about some of those cases.
Okay.
At least articles in journals.
I sure will. I'm always writing.
That's important, I think. Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much.
All right, good night.
Good night.